This week on The Score.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We look back at the Apollo 11 moon landing, which happened 50 years ago this week. Keep listening to this special golden anniversary episode of The Score.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere, and this is a special edition of the show. I had the pleasure of speaking with experts about space travel, astronomers, and historians to remember the Apollo 11 moon landing on July 20th, 1969, 50 years ago today. Our first conversation is with Tom McChrystal, Chief Technology Officer at Creative Perspectives in Charlottesville and a longtime space enthusiast. I asked him about the origins of the Apollo program.
Set the stage for us back in 1960, 61, 62, before President Kennedy announced his intention of getting a man to the moon and back within a decade. What was going on in NASA, in the Pentagon, that was propelling us towards that aim?
Well, clearly you have to see the whole Apollo program in the context of the Cold War. You know, one of the things that we forget nowadays, and I think the legacy of the Kennedys has gotten a little bit fuzzy about this, but John Kennedy was a hawk. I mean, he was a hawk along the lines of Reagan being a hawk. And I think they're, I'm not sure that Kennedy really cared necessarily about the space program, but he cared very deeply about out-competing the Soviet Union. And this was a place where we could compete with the Soviet Union and not have to worry about getting everybody in the world killed. It seems to me that if you're going to have a contest about what world leader in the last 200 years has the biggest steel balls, you would have to look to Kennedy, because when he said, let's go to the moon, we had exactly 15 minutes and 22 seconds of manned space experience. And then we went up to 1,000 kilometers, and he said, okay, so let's go 500 times further. We've never been in orbit. Let's orbit the Earth and orbit the Moon. We've never done anything other than splash this can down into the Atlantic Ocean. Let's land on the Moon. Let's go walk on it. Let's bring those guys back. You know, and he really framed it. I mean, no single achievement will be more impressive to mankind, and that still looms true. We had a bunch of German rocket scientists that couldn't get jobs nowadays because of political correctness. The Soviets had their set of German rocket scientists. Interestingly, even though they came out of wartime, von Braun and guys on the Russian side were thinking about peaceful uses of space. And we went out and we duked it out. And we duked it out starting, you know, giving them a 20-yard head start. To me, it was impressive, not only because when Kennedy said, let's do this thing, it was impossible. We hadn't even done all of the things necessary to get to the point where, you know, it was impossible to get to the point where it was possible.
Who was whispering in Kennedy's ear? Who was telling him, this is something that we should aim for, and who believed that it was possible when it was impossible?
Well, there were a lot of people. I mean, von Braun was very, very vocal about, you know, here's what we need to do. And they were designing big rockets at the time. You know, there was a rocket that they were working on that dwarfed the Saturn V, which is still the biggest, most capable rocket ever designed. And in fact, when we finally get around to launching NASA's Space Launch System, the Saturn V will still have been the most capable rocket ever designed. Beautiful piece of engineering. But you also, I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson, I think, doesn't get as much credit as he probably ought to, because he was really the mechanic. He built the coalition in Congress. You know, he really, if it were not for Lyndon Johnson, Apollo would not have happened. You know, and I look at it obviously from a political and public policy standpoint, but if we didn't have somebody out there saying, you guys need to write a really big check, and you need to write that really big check for a few years, Apollo would not have happened.
Yeah, I imagine the appropriations process was probably a bit difficult. There were skeptics in Congress who probably didn't want to fund this kind of program.
There were a ton of skeptics. And in fact, there are many people who have made the point, and of which I agree, that if John Kennedy had not been tragically assassinated, we would very likely not have, at the very least, made the decade goal. You know, again, Kennedy was a cold warrior and was less interested in this than people thought. And we also have this, you know, in hindsight, we think of, oh, the country was so behind this program. Support for the manned space program during the Apollo era never got higher above 48%. You know, it's no higher now or no less now than it used to be. You know, and again, I think it's testament to the political side of that, where Kennedy and Johnson really honchoed this thing through Congress. They honchoed it through public opinion. We did something that had, you know, at the time was impossible.
And it wasn't a linear series of achievements. There were setbacks too, like the Apollo 1 fire. What was the effect on public opinion? Did people say, no, we shouldn't do it now? Or did they say, well, let's go forward anyway?
Well, the impact on public opinion was, you know, not as much as you might expect. It was kind of a blip, and in some ways, people almost said, you know, okay, so now we have these martyrs, we have to do this thing. I think the most important impact of Apollo 1, and this gets lost in, you know, when we have setbacks, when bad things happen nowadays, you know, you have to have a commission and you have to find the people to blame and then you find somebody else to blame. The very famously, Gene Kranz, who was one of the senior flight controllers, flight directors, went into his, the next day after Apollo 1, went into his office and wrote on his chalkboard, tough and competent. And he gave this very famous speech about flight control, basically saying, we screwed up. This is our fault. We saw all the warning signs, and we pressed ahead. And from now on, we have to be tough, and we have to be competent. You know, and it really, he makes the point. He thinks that Apollo 11 would not have happened without, paradoxically, without the Apollo 1 tragedy.
Well, I imagine from an engineering standpoint, they were able to learn how to improve the system from what went wrong and leading to the deaths of the three astronauts.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways, they never found the proximate cause of that problem. I mean, they found everything that happened. They never found the source for the ignition, but they were in a hyper-pressurized 100% oxygen environment. Stuff burned. You know, stuff that you didn't think would burn, burned. You know, you can only imagine what might have happened if that had happened in space. They weren't ready. I mean, I think it was Ed White, but one of the Apollo 1 astronauts said, how are we going to pull this off if we can't talk between three buildings? They were having such communication problems.
This was before email.
Yeah, this was before email. This was, I mean, they were having a hard time talking from the capsule to launch control in at Cape Canaveral and to mission control in Houston. You know, that tragedy in a lot of ways caused everybody to fall back. There were a ton of things that were redesigned. The hatch was redesigned. They went through the Apollo capsule and removed everything that was flammable. Not everything that might be flammable, but everything that in that environment would be flammable. You know, we have kind of a culture where everybody wants to press blame off to everybody else. And I think one of the things that was unique is everyone involved in that owned the problem. Flight controllers owned the problem. The engineers owned the problem. The mission directors owned the problem. The astronauts owned the problem. Because there was a lot, you know, astronauts were involved in saying, okay, this is ready, even when they knew that capsule was not ready.
Mm-hmm. We only have a few seconds left, maybe 45 seconds. What are your memories of July 20th, 1969? Where were you? What were you doing?
I was in my parents' living room. I was 10 years old, or just getting ready to turn, actually just getting ready to turn 9 years old, in my parents' living room watching on a black and white TV. It was the first time I had ever been allowed to stay up past 10 o'clock. And, you know, in this age of high definition, you don't realize, you know, how blurry those pictures were, but they were some of the most stirring pictures, I think, I've ever seen in my entire 50-plus years of life.
If there's any television event that had everybody in the world looking at their sets, if they had a set available, that was it.
That was it. I mean, there was a great documentary, In the Shadow of the Moon, and the tagline was, remember when we all looked up. And I think that's just, if only we could get back to the point where everybody all looked up again.
Space is open to us now, and our eagerness to share its meaning is not governed by the efforts of others. We go into space because whatever mankind must undertake, free men must fully share. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. If we make this judgment affirmatively, it will be an entire nation. For all of us must work to put him there.
One small step for man, one giant leap for Bering Drift. You're listening to The Score with Rick Sincere.
I had a unique and exciting opportunity to talk to two astronomers about the moon landing, including one who participated in the Apollo program, Dr. Lawrence Frederick. He's the former chairman of the astronomy department at the University of Virginia. Included in our conversation is current UVA professor Ed Murphy.
Dr. Ed Murphy, I'm going to start with a question that may seem like it's out of left field. After the Americans had the first moon landing, why did the Soviets never go to the moon with people?
Oh, I think in the end the Soviets never went to the moon because they just never were able to develop a rocket that could get them to the moon, and they didn't have the technological ability at the time.
And Dr. Frederick, you were at NASA, you were helping to develop the landing site on the moon. And what were the criteria that went into developing the landing site on the moon? What were you looking for a good landing site?
Well, the geologists were the ones who were interested in looking at layers of the moon and learning about how the moon was formed, et cetera, et cetera. Astronomically, I wasn't interested in the shape of the moon at all. I was interested more in the dynamics, things like that.
How would people know what the geology of the moon was like without having been there?
Well, they could use robots, and all the people who did went to the moon was take pictures of these chasms and look at the strata. And so they could have done it mechanically without all the problems of taking a man up and getting him back.
Dr. Murphy, the moon project took less than 10 years, but at the beginning, we didn't really know whether we'd be able to make it. What kind of technology was available off the shelf, and what had to be created from scratch in that decade?
You know, spaceflight was so young. In 1961, when President Kennedy said that we were going to go to the moon, the United States had all of one spaceflight done. And so all of it had to be developed. There was very little technology when it came to spaceflight. So they didn't really have a legacy that they could build on. They were really building the whole program from scratch. Now, the Mercury program was already underway. Those were very simple, single-person spacecraft, low Earth orbit. But it was really the Gemini program that was the building blocks to get to Apollo, where they would do in-orbit rendezvous, they would do two-person spacecraft, they would spend long periods of time in space. That was the practice that was needed to get to Apollo.
You mentioned during the panel discussion that the goals of the moon mission were not essentially scientific, but there were scientific discoveries. From an astronomer's point of view, what did we learn during the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo missions about the galaxy? What did we learn beyond the moon?
You know, we didn't learn much beyond the moon, although there were some experiments. One of the Apollo experiments that was carried was an ultraviolet telescope. Ultraviolet light doesn't make it through the ozone layer, so you need to be out in space to see it. And some of the Apollo spacecraft, particularly on Apollo 17, carried an ultraviolet spectrograph that had been built at Johns Hopkins University that was actually used to study stars and the interstellar medium, the gas between the stars. But really, there was very little that came out of Apollo initially that affected astronomy outside of the solar system. Really, what it was teaching us about the history of our solar system and how the planets formed in our solar system, what the early solar system was like. And those were tremendously important for all of our future exploration of the solar system.
A similar question for you, Dr. Frederick. You were working on astronomy in the 1950s and 60s. As the Apollo program went on and beyond, how did the tools you use as an astronomer change over the past 60 years?
Automation. That's one. Secondly is computers. Completely different. And Apollo was crucial to that. They put a IBM, 351 or something, which took up a room, into a suitcase. The suitcase didn't have the ability of the telephone, of a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a big step, a huge step.
The miniaturization, I imagine, you know, I've been to the Air and Space Museum. I've seen the Apollo command module. It seems very small, but when you look at the film, it seemed roomy for the astronauts. But was it? And how did they fit all that equipment, the extra spacesuits, all the food, the oxygen? How did that all fit in that small space?
So I will say it was very small. I mean, even the Apollo command module, which in that movie looks very spacious, it really is still very cramped. It's you and your two crewmates in a volume that's about the same as the inside of a minivan. So imagine spending 12 days inside of a minivan with two other people. Stored inside that minivan is also all the food you're going to eat over the next couple days, this computer, your equipment, these chairs that you're sitting in. They really were quite cramped.
But how did they fit so much stuff in there with so little space available?
Just engineering. I mean, they really just figured out they took advantage of every little space that they had. One thing that they could do once they were in orbit was the chairs would fold away and get out of the way because they didn't need the chairs anymore. That would provide them a little more freedom. One of the reasons it looks like it's so spacious is in those videos, the chairs are folded away so they have a little bit more room to work.
So it was like a big game of Tetris.
It was, yes. Yep.
Just what are your thoughts 50 years after the moon landing? You saw it. You knew the astronauts. You knew Neil Armstrong. Dr. Frederick, how do you feel that we're talking about this so long, so many years afterwards?
Well, it was spectacular. And it still is. That was a remarkable accomplishment in essentially 8.5, 9 years.
Well, what's really remarkable is it was only 66 years from the Wright brothers' airplane to landing on the moon. Who would have thought?
Yeah. Sure. All right.
Well, Dr. Murphy...
I wanted to point out another quick thing. Larry, by the way, wrote the original report about building a telescope in space.
Oh.
So when you asked him about how technology has changed, I thought he might bring that up, that he was on a panel that studied the first space telescope and actually wrote the report for that panel about about building a telescope in space, which ultimately became the Hubble Space Telescope.
Well, congratulations. I had no idea. Thank you for doing that. Dr. Murphy, Dr. Frederick, thank you for being here tonight. It's a pleasure to talk to you about the Apollo mission 50 years later.
We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. I do not say that we should or will go unprotected against the hostile misuse of space any more than we go unprotected against the hostile use of land or sea. But I do say that space can be explored and mastered without feeding the fires of war, without repeating the mistakes that man has made in extending his writ around this globe of ours. There is no strife, no prejudice, no national conflict in outer space as yet. Its hazards are hostile to us all. Its conquest deserves the best of all mankind. And its opportunity for peaceful cooperation may never come again. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
This is a special episode of The Score with Rick Sincere, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing.
When The Score returns, our arts critic Tim Halsey reviews two movies about Apollo 11, and political scientist Larry Sabato will discuss the politics of the space program in the 1960s. There's more than that coming too, so don't go away.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.